Okay, good morning, members. I'm going to call the Human Services Finance Policy Committee to order. And today, members, we have two bills and two division reports that we'll be going over. Lindsay Hansen, Ms. Hansen, can you take the roll, please?
Yes, of course. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher's on the way. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel?
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Mueller?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Noor?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson? Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Sandell?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members. And this is our 50th meeting. I just noticed.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Wow, a milestone, 50. Okay, well, we do have a quorum, so thanks everyone for being here. Let's see, Representative Albright, would you like to approve the minutes from, or make a motion to approve the minutes from February 24th?
Madam Chair, I would motion, make that motion, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Not seeing any. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Okay, the first bill on our agenda is House File 3439. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Wolgamott. Special day, it's our 50th meeting. I see that you have a DE amendment. Would you like to amend that before we discuss your bill?
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's an honor to be back in your committee, and I would greatly appreciate if the committee would adopt that amendment so that I can get the bill in the shape that I would like it to be in.
Okay, I'm going to move to amend House File 3439 with the DE2 amendment. This is a voice vote, members. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So my motion is to lay over House File 3439 as amended for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. So Representative Wolgamott, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. It's an honor to be here today to present to you House File 3439, which is a bill that was brought to me by two of the counties that I serve, Sherburne County and Stearns County, as well as the Minnesota Inter-County Association. It addresses the county cost share relating to individuals who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous and are in a state-operated facility. A facility, for example, is the Anoka Metropolitan Regional Treatment Center or a community behavioral health hospital. Madam Chair, members and Minnesota statutes state that counties are 100% responsible for the cost of care when the aforementioned facilities determine it is clinically appropriate for the client to be discharged. Although the client may no longer need the hospitalization level of care at an RTC or a CBHH, they do need treatment. For a person civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous, that means St. Peter, another state-operated facility. The issue here is that counties have no ability to address situations where clients are being released from one state-operated facility and are awaiting a bed at another state-operated facility. Yet again, current statute requires counties to pay 100% of the cost for individuals in that situation who are just stuck in limbo until a bed becomes available. So that's the issue that this bill intends to address, is to change the requirement that counties are responsible for paying for those mentally ill and dangerous individuals that are stuck at the Anoka Metropolitan Regional Treatment Center or a community behavioral health hospital while they're awaiting a bed at St. Peter, Just a little bit of context for you, Madam Chair and members. The daily rate at MRTC is $1,600, which I'm sure, as you can imagine, adds up quickly. You know, ultimately, this is something that is kind of decided by the state, and so it is most appropriate for the state to be paying for it, not the counties. So anyway, that is my bill. That's our intention, and I have two testifiers who are also here to provide input on this with your permission, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. We have with us Ms. Amanda Larson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Amanda Larson, and I serve as the Health and Human Services Director in Sherburne County. I'm testifying on behalf of Sherburne County, MICA, and MACSA, Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. As Representative Wolgamott stated, counties are responsible for paying 100% of the cost of care when individuals are in state hospitals but no longer need that hospitalization level of care. We call this DNMC, does not meet criteria. However, for individuals who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, they are not being released out in the community. And while medically they might not meet certain criteria for hospitalization, counties really have no ability to effectuate a transfer to a bed of forensic services, better known as St. Peter, because it's another state-operated facility. This past year, Sherburne County had an individual placed at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, AMRTC, on December 24th, 2020. On May 24th, this person was declared ready for discharge at AMRTC. However, this person still needed treatment. The mentally ill and dangerous petition had already been filed in April. So as soon as this person was declared DNMC, it started the clock for 100% county pay, as this person has already been determined not appropriate to be released in the community and was awaiting a bed at St. Peter. 1 year later, December 29, 2021, this person was finally transferred to St. Peter, and it cost Sherburne County property taxpayers $339,122 as they awaited a state bed to accept him. This one individual remained at AMRTC for 219 days at a cost of $1,600 per day. Counties recognize, and we know that there's a very real bed shortage across the state. We feel it too every single day. We also recognize that a confluence of other factors in 2020 and 2021 exacerbated these shortages, such as COVID and staffing shortages. But really, as again, Representative Wolgamott stated, the primary issues that counties are working to address in this piece of legislation is that when an individual who is committed as mentally ill and dangerous is in a state facility, awaiting placement in another state facility, county property taxpayers should not be held liable for these DNMC days. Just to put it again in a little bit of perspective, in 2021, Sherburne County's Regional Treatment Center budget was $375,000 for the year. So really this one placement effectively doubled what we paid out in overall costs. I thank you for your time. I'm available for questions or stand for another colleague to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. The next testifier we have is Julie Ellis. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Ellis, and I'm the Director of Adult and Disability Services in Stearns County. I'm representing Stearns County, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, or MICA, and the Minnesota Association of Community Social Service Administrators, or MACSA, in my testimony today. Forensic beds are at capacity in Minnesota, and individuals are stuck in beds that are inappropriate to their needs and unable to move because there's not a bed available. Counties are billed 100% of the cost of care when an individual no longer meets medical criteria for hospitalization, yet are powerless to move the individuals to their next bed under a mentally ill and dangerous commitment. I'd like to share a recent example in which our county was billed under this provision. Our individual was committed to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center under Rule 20. On July 13, 2021, the court committed him as mentally ill and dangerous. Our county received the does not meet medical criteria notification just 3 days later, July 16, 2021. A bed was not made available for him until nearly 2 months later, September 9th, 2021, at which time he was transferred to a forensic bed by direct care and treatment. The total cost to our county for that 55-day stay in an inappropriate bed was $87,298.80. This individual needed a forensic bed, which could only be made available by direct care and treatment. It is unfair to hold counties financially responsible for bed days at the cost of $1,600 a day when they have absolutely no control over moving the individual to the next appropriate bed. The examples that we've shared this morning are just a small number of situations where this scenario has occurred. Many other instances involving even larger amounts of county levy dollars exist, some large enough that they could consume a small county's entire human services budget. It's time to end this unfair practice. Thank you for hearing my testimony this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. We also have Nancy Selesky with us, and she's available for questions. Okay, any questions, members, related to the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It really highlights, I think, one of the most egregious problems that we face in the state in terms of dealing with and assisting those that are fighting mental illness. I do have a question for, and I'm not sure if this is pertinent to DHS or for one of the testifiers, but do we make a distinction between, and I'm going to use some terms here, do we make a distinction for commitment between sexually psychopathic or sexually dangerous as opposed to commitments for mentally ill and dangerous?
I don't know if one of the testifiers has that answer. Ms. Ellis.
Madam, I can try to answer that. They are all separate commitments, so the petition would be filed under one of those three. This actual amendment would be just for the MIND. The other two are already covered, and counties are not billed for 100% of the cost of their care when they're waiting for a bed.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This obviously is a commitment that the state needs to step up to. Unfortunately, I see that we have not received the fiscal note. I'm sure it's been requested. But to the author of the bill and or the testifiers, I would note, and this is important because words matter, I would note that this obligation on behalf of the counties they are absolved of it if it is going from one state treatment facility to another state facility. But if their treatment is such that they no longer need to be taken care of in a state facility and treatment would be better served at a county facility, does the clock start when they are discharged, even though the county, I mean, what the county is really predisposed to accept them. So what happens in that case if the county doesn't have space?
Let's see, Ms. Ellis or Ms. Larson or Ms. Selesky?
Madam Chair, I can.
Ms. Ellis?
I can. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So once an individual is ready for community placement, it would be the county's responsibility to pay for that care until they found an appropriate placement. And we accept that responsibility, and we are shouldering those financial responsibilities now.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is obviously something that has a large fiscal note, and this is probably a question for you as chair of the committee, but it seems like there are a number of bills that we've heard, and this is probably a larger point, but has the author of the bill considered what the possibility would be for that fiscal note? Is it scalable, or what is he anticipating for the ask, if you will? Has he considered it? Is he waiting for the fiscal note to consider what that might look like because of the number of cases that might be pertinent to his bill?
Yeah, I don't want to speculate on the fiscal note until I see it, but I have heard from my county about this issue as well. So they'll have to give us an estimate of the number of people or who are in this situation in the past, and then create a forecast of the cost. Representative Vogelma?
Can I say it better myself, Madam Chair? I certainly don't want to speculate until we get the fiscal note, but would be more than happy to have any of our testifiers today speak to their experiences in their individual counties.
Would any of the testifiers like to address the cost, potential cost? But I think we've already heard that in one case it was over $300,000. So I think we will get a fiscal note, Representative Albright, and when we do, we will bring it to the committee so we can review it. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is for Ms. Stearns and a comment that she made regarding individuals that are committed under the SDP and the SPP, said that the counties are not responsible for 100% of that coverage until they get placed. Is that implying that they're responsible for partial, I guess, would be my first question.
Ms. Ellis?
Madam Chair, I would like to respond to that question. We do pay a share for those ongoing costs, and I apologize, I don't have the percentage in front of me right now. I believe it has to do with when they were placed, and there was a date where it changed to 25%, and it was 10% prior. But I don't have that information in front of me. But we do pay an ongoing cost, and those commitments are longer-term commitments. So individuals spend quite a bit of time in that treatment facility if it's a sex offender.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second question I would have is just if DHS would have anything that they would want to weigh in with.
Ms. Carrie Briones, I'm sorry. Can you pronounce your name for the record and state your affiliation, then try to answer the question?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Carrie Briones, and I'm from the Department of Human Services in DCT. Madam Chair, and to your question, Representative Frederick, we would like to continue to work with the counties on the amended language. We do have some concerns about it. We're still looking at it and looking at what the impacts will be. We do know that the language and the amendment will put the liability for payment back on the patient. So we do have some concerns about that.
Thank you, Ms. Briones. Representative Frederick.
I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Final word, Representative Vogelma.
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair and members. And on behalf of Sherwood County and Stearns County and all the counties that make up the Minnesota Intercounty Association, I appreciate your consideration to support House File 3439. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamont, and thank you to the testifiers for joining us today. So with that, members, House File 3439, as amended, we laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Okay, next up on the agenda, we have House File 3863. So my motion is to lay over House File 3863 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Bolden, I believe this is your bill. Do you want to introduce it and then we can go to the testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this happy to introduce House File 3863, which is a DCT technical and policy bill, and we've got a few folks from DHS on the call here. I think it probably would be helpful to have them walk through the bill first, if we could, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. So, Ms. Briones, please introduce yourself again and then proceed with the overview.
Good morning. My name is Carrie Briones, and I am with the Department of Human Services, the Direct Care and Treatment. Chair and members, I'm going to go over sections 1, 3, and 4 of the bill. And if it's okay if I do that all at once, I didn't want to make it harder for the committee to go through it. So in section 1 of the proposed language, it addresses with our frequency in which we are submitting a quarterly clinical report. And this report has 7 different data points, and it on 3 facilities, which is our Anoka Metro Treatment Center, Minnesota Security Hospital, which we refer to as Forensic Services, and our Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. This report mandate was passed back in 2016 based on a stakeholder request. We have met with that stakeholder. That stakeholder is okay with us changing the frequency to an annual report. And we are also able to get that those data points to that stakeholder or others if requested. And I can pause if anybody has questions on this one.
Any questions on section one of the bill? Not seeing any questions. Please proceed, Ms. Briones.
Sure, so we're gonna move to section three, and this is also relates to a report frequency, and this is our census and data project data, fiscal census and fiscal projections data. And we submit it each year for state operated services and the Minnesota Sex Offender. This data is sent with a November and February budget forecast. The data between November and February doesn't change significantly, so we are seeking to just submit it in February. We have reached out to MMB and they are okay with this change.
Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. Please proceed.
Sure. And so I'm going to go to the section four of the bill is simply repealer language, and there are three items in that section that we are seeking to have removed. The first item is regarding enterprise and establishing enterprise language. This language was passed back in 1999, and it was for us to bring up adolescent services to an enterprise activity. Within 2 years, we moved an appropriation model. We have not used that language since. We do not have any intentions to do so. We would have an ability to come back and ask the legislature in the future if we needed to go that route. So we're looking to remove that. The second item addresses closed programs. The first is the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options, which we refer to as NETO, and the MSHS Cambridge. Both programs were closed in result of the Jensen litigation, and NETO closed in 2011 and MSHS closed in 2014. And the last item is our regional treatment catchment areas. And we just don't use these geographic areas anymore because access to the appropriate clinical services is no longer limited like it was when the language passed.
Thank you, Ms. Briones. I see a question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a term of definition elaboration, when you say designated catchment area, could you inform everyone what that really means? Thank you.
Ms. Briones.
Chair and members, it's a bit of a mouthful for myself as well. My understanding is that there is this geographic area set up within the state so that we could almost, I want to say, like target areas to make sure that individuals were able to get to the correct treatment areas.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, then to follow up, does that denote that there isn't a plan in place or focus on adding new regional treatment centers? Have you gone away from that model and you're focusing on what exists? Or since you're removing that language, how would you move forward to create those regional treatment centers going forward?
Ms. Briones.
Chair and members, I might have to defer to my colleague, Dr. Stevens, who's on the call as well.
Thank you. Dr. Stevens, please introduce yourself for the record. And if you have an answer to the question, please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I am Dr. Kylie Ann Stevens. I'm the Executive Medical Director for Behavioral Health for Direct Care and Treatment. In this case, I do believe I have an answer to the question. We're not looking to expand regional treatment centers, but rather this allows for more flexibility in where we're able to place individuals to receive care. Sometimes it's more appropriate for them, for an individual to be admitted to a hospital closer to a large medical center, for example, even though they might be from a rural area. Or perhaps a bed is available faster, a little bit further away. So while we try to place individuals close to where they live from a practical standpoint, it's not always possible or appropriate.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, I wouldn't say it's concerning, but it's curious that you don't intend to look forward with any new regional treatment facilities, particularly in light of the demand itself. How would you respond to, as you said, and I've heard in testimony before the committee yet this morning, that we are running up against and having no margin for beds available for counties and otherwise for, you know, some of these cases. Could you explain how your initiatives going forward are going to address the scarcity of beds if you remove this language? How are you going to rectify the situation in other ways?
Dr. Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a very large question, respectfully. So I don't pretend to know, I don't want to speak for the whole department when we talk about that. When we're talking about this change in particular, however, we are trying to make the best use of our beds that we have in existence right now and serve the people where the most medically appropriate bed is for them. So that's what this language does. And I would ask to defer the other larger question, if you please.
That is a big question, Representative Albright, one that we have to solve this session. So we'll be coming back to that. And Dr. Stevens, do you want to proceed and review section two, and then we can open it up for more questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you so much. Thanks for your time today to explain all of the sections, but we'll be focusing on section two as you indicated here. This change applies to people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous and who have been approved for transfer from the secure building, or MSH, which most people know it as, and into a non-secure program operated by Forensic Services in St. Peter. So to clarify, the person is still being treated at Forensic Services, just in a non-secure unit. They do have the full complement of treatment staff, but more liberties and opportunities to practice the skills they've learned in the secure setting. This change allows those individuals to voluntarily return to the secure building for up to 60 days if needed to receive services. This generally is helpful when a person needs added support, medication changes, or other programming. And if the person does not stabilize within 60 days, their transfer to that non-secure program is revoked, and they will remain in the secure building until their symptoms are stabilized and they're deemed safe to return to the non-secure program. The Special Review Board authorizes all transfers to a non-secure program in this circumstance, and the individual has a right to appeal the revocation to the SRB on an expedited basis. If the person does stabilize within the 60 days, and the majority do, fortunately, they may transfer back to the non-secure program without waiting for an SRB hearing, which sometimes can take a good deal of time. This bill also gives the forensic medical director the authority to revoke someone's transfer to the non-secure facility if they are deemed unsafe, either to themselves or the public, and a voluntary return is not reasonable. The individual and their attorney receives the reasons for revocation in writing and may appeal those decisions to the Special Review Board, and that is done on an expedited basis. These changes are aligned with what is currently permitted in statute for individuals on provisional discharge to other non-forensic programs, so the language mirrors that in many ways. And from a physician perspective, I would just like to close by noting that someone voluntarily engaging in decision-making about their health and accepting more help when needed really indicates they're taking responsibility for their care and safety. And we strive to empower individuals to work with us in this manner. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Stevens. Any questions for DHS? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stevens, and I really appreciate the way you laid out that. The only question that I would have is just if you could elaborate in terms of voluntarily return. There have been a number of cases where voluntary determination by the patient has gone awry. So I'm just, could you just elaborate in terms of that voluntary return to the secure facility for the benefit of the committee?
Dr. Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. In circumstances such as this, we're generally in the situation where someone has increased symptoms in the non-secure program and requires stabilization. So in that case, it consists of a conversation with the patient or the individual about the increased symptoms and whether or not it would be advisable for them to return to the secure building in order to receive the added level of safety and support there in order to make those changes. So it's a conversation where the person would agree to come back into the secure program.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Stevens, thank you for that. In the conversation that you would have with the client, particularly where it is recommended that they return to the secure facility, but they don't do that voluntarily, is there a professional override of that from the perspective of protecting not only the community, but also the client? Could you just affirm that for me? And then that would be the conclusion. Thank you.
Dr. Stevens.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is included in this bill. If a person does not choose to return voluntarily or there's an immediate safety concern, the forensic medical director has the ability to revoke that transfer to the program and back into the secure facility, and that takes place immediately.
Thank you, Dr. Stevens. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment, and I want to say thank you, Dr. Stevens, for coming and testifying too for this. I think this is a good bill. For someone that has worked in St. Peter there for 17 years, I can say that I've seen patients go and move into the transition programs outside of the secure perimeter. And sometimes that change alone can be really scary. And that change and that those feelings can increase some of the symptoms of their mental illness. And so I don't want to be too generalized in some of my comments, but being able to kind of dip their toe in the water, kind of see how it goes, and if they can have a bad reaction, needing to go back into the secure perimeter and then have kind of that reset and go back again can help them be most successful going through the program. So again, I think this is a really good bill, and I look forward to supporting it.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Really appreciate your experience and helping educate all of us in the public. Are there any final comments? Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, again, would thank Dr. Stevens and Ms. Briones, and thank you to Representative Frederick as well for bringing in your expertise and experience and perspective in this, and look forward to member support. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. So with that, members, House File 3863 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Okay, next up we have House File 1929, and I'm going to move to adopt the division report from Chair Fisher and the Behavioral Health Division. This is going to be a voice vote. All those in favor to adopt the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. So this House File 1929 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill, and that is my motion. Representative Bonner, do you want to introduce the bill?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Schultz. There's nothing harder than watching someone you love struggle, barely recognizing the person you know and love, wondering if the essence of who they are remains beneath the surface, to feel them slip through your fingers. Psychosis is a disabling condition that disrupts thoughts and reality, making reality seem fluid and hard to grasp. You may hear or see things others don't, leading to anxiety and depression, pulling away from family and friends, which often leads to delayed calls for help by as long as 74 weeks on average, only to face a wait list. Far too little, far too late. Psychosis can be triggered by conditions like schizophrenia, one of the most debilitating conditions in the world. Early psychosis or first episode psychosis is frightening for those who live it and painful for families to watch or comprehend. Often starting in early adulthood, we don't know how to prevent these conditions, but we know psychosis is the first warning sign. Groundbreaking research has shown early intervention can dramatically alter the trajectory of the life of those who experience it. In addition to the human cost, it costs our economy upwards of $155 billion a year in direct health care costs and expenses. For this reason, states have mandated to dedicate 10% of their federal behavioral health block grant to first episode programs. The need is real. The current programs in the state are overflowing and have a wait list of 4 months, which is the longest since the program's inception, while only meeting less than half of the current need. The bill invests in programs proven to provide greater improvements in symptoms, relationships, quality of life, and greater engagement in work or school. We know early intervention equals better outcomes before it's too late. This bill expands holistic practices that include family in the recovery, to include bipolar and extreme depression, and seeks to expand it to meet the increasing need across the state. I bring this bill today as someone who knows what it feels like to be helpless, watching someone that I love deeply feel as if they're slipping away. This bill does more than just fill a line item on a budget. It provides hope for patients and for families who desperately need it. With that, members, I do have a handout on first episode psychosis in your packets that you may refer to for more information on this topic. And today I do have two testifiers with me today to speak on this.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And members, just a reminder, this bill we heard last year, but it was brought back because it was amended in Chair Fisher's committee, Behavioral Health Division. Representative Bonner, can you just remind us what the appropriation is in the bill?
Yeah, the appropriation, we actually have a amended appropriation for the bill. And let me see, do I have that up to refer to it? I apologize, Chair Schultz, I do not. We did have an amendment drafted to match that of the governor's budget. However, unfortunately, it did not make the deadline, so we did not have that before us today.
What was the old appropriation?
The
current that's currently in the bill?
I believe we have Sue Abderholden here as well.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. We had left that appropriation blank, but it's $2 million and then $4 million from the governor's budget.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Okay, we'll go to the first testifier. So I just also want to remind members that we had more testifiers in Chair Fisher's committee, and this is more of an abbreviated testimony. So we have with us today Dr. Piper Meyer-Kalos from the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name again for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and committee members. My name is Piper Meyer-Kalos, and I am an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I want to thank you for this opportunity to tell you about how First Episode Psychosis programs have helped young people in Minnesota. I was one of the original researchers who developed the coordinated specialty care treatment model used in Minnesota called Navigate. Getting young people the right care as soon as possible is vitally important to changing the trajectory of a serious mental illness. Imagine for a moment what it would be like bringing your loved one or child into a mental health center for the first time. What would you want that experience to look like? How could we best help young people to get back on track and understand the strange or unusual experiences that they've had? I would like to share one person's story of experiencing the symptoms of psychosis for the first time. When this young person, who we can call Jack, came to the program, he had run away twice and been hospitalized twice because he believed that people were after him. He was afraid for his life and afraid of the messages he was receiving from the voices he heard. Jack only came to the early psychosis program because his parents convinced him to give it a try. It took several months for Jack to open up about his experiences, but he kept coming back to the program because he was able to talk about what was important to him, which was getting back to school. Initially, his focus was on school and less on his symptoms, but he opened up about his paranoia and voices because he wanted to get back on track with school. Jack worked with different members of the team who helped him with his medication, with his paranoia, and with applying to college. Jack's parents also had a place to learn more about Jack's experiences. In many other programs, Jack may not have gotten the help he needed, but the Navigate program was tailored to meet Jack exactly where he was and focus on what he wanted, which was to go back to school. Did you know that 3 times as many young people who have experienced psychosis will drop out of school compared to their peers? The experience of psychosis can be devastating to the individual, their family, and the people around them, but Navigate programs can help. Coordinated specialty care or early psychosis programs are comprehensive, multidisciplinary treatment approaches designed to help people right when they need help the most, after the earliest experiences of psychosis. These evidence-based programs help people learn how to manage their symptoms, provide support for their family members, and help people get back to work and school. Early intervention with coordinated specialty care is essential to move away from a costly, crisis-driven model to delivering effective, recovery-oriented care that improves young lives and strengthens families. The pandemic has made mental health treatment and early psychosis even more important, as we have seen rates for early psychosis rise across the U.S. and the world. Minnesota is leading the way to better and more innovative approaches. Our team in psychiatry is building our evidence-based coordinated specialty care teams to meet the needs of urban and greater Minnesota. We are currently developing a model to expand coordinated specialty care treatment to include treatment for early bipolar disorder to better serve and reach individuals in greater Minnesota using existing resources and funding. Minnesota is seen as a top leader in the treatment of first episode psychosis and has been approached by leaders in other states, such as California, to learn more about the expansion of our coordinated specialty care model to include early bipolar disorder. As these early intervention programs expand into greater Minnesota, it is important that we serve the most people possible through the inclusion of early bipolar disorder and consider the additional needs of people in rural areas, such as housing. Now is an important turning point for the funding of these programs because they are integrated in our communities. People referred are getting these programs earlier than they ever have before. The time to expand them is now. We know that if we do not fund these programs, the risk is greater, including a much higher risk of suicide and long-term struggles with disability and functioning. This bill will increase funding to expand the number of first episode psychosis programs and develop a new early mood disorder program for when someone develops a mood disorder like bipolar disorder. I see firsthand the need for the increased access to these critical specialized services and the significant improvements that individuals with psychosis and mood disorders can achieve through these programs. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer-Kalos. So members, we don't have any of the testifiers, but we do have Ms. Abderholden from NAMI here to answer questions and Christy Grom from DHS. So are there any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's notable that existing law does already allow for grant funding for interventions for first episodes of psychosis. So I know that you asked the author, funding, and Ms. Abderholden expressed it, but is this a scalable program, or are you looking for all or nothing on this? And I have a follow-up question.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it costs roughly $450 to $500,000 to add a program. We had, using the New York model, and our population figured we need at least 8 in Minnesota to be able to meet the needs. So we will obviously, take whatever dollars we can to keep expanding the program. But we know there's just a huge need out there.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the fact that we've had past funding for these types of programs, and either to Ms. Abderholden or to the author of the bill, what successes have we seen from previous funding for these programs?
Ms. Abderholden or Dr. Meyer-Kalos? Dr. Meyer-Kalos, please proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm happy to share that these programs have all been successful, and actually they serve as a model for programs across the country. unlike other programs in other states, the programs in Minnesota have always had a regular stream of referrals. Many times when these programs are up and going, they have to spend a lot of time recruiting people because when you get ill for the first time, you don't often believe you need treatment right away. And so there's a lot of recruitment. It's unusual, but Minnesota has a lot of good grassroots, and you've seen these programs continually have referrals and get full. And now we in fact do have a waiting list. The other thing that you'll see in these programs is that people are discharging, people are going back to school and work. So it shows that they're really working and they're very successful.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note that the title enacting language talks about first episode psychosis and mood disorder. So I'm wondering if someone could give the committee members kind of a definitional difference between the two. And I note that the bill authorizes funding for both. So where is the emphasis going to happen? And one is startup, one is existing. Just kind of give us a lay of land in terms of what is going to go on going forward, given the fact that we have grant programs already in existence.
I would like to take that question. Dr. Meyer Kalos or Ms. Abderholden? Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So psychosis is kind of like getting it out of touch with reality, right? So you have delusional thoughts. You might think someone's following you when they're not. You have hallucinations. Bipolar disorder is very different. So you either usually have a combination of being very seriously depressed or experiencing mania. And we know that bipolar disorder can be very disabling for young people, especially if they don't get really intensive services right away. And many, frankly, end up in not great places. They can end up in our criminal justice system, end up hospitalized over and over, things like that. So they are two different illnesses, similar approaches in terms of really supporting these young people. And again, while we have an existing program, we are building on what works. And we don't have enough in Greater Minnesota in particular to be able to meet their needs. And this is not a residential program. This is a community-based program. And so we need to make sure that we also have programs in other parts of the state. This particular model is used across the world because it is recognized as being so effective in intervening early with these very, very serious mental illnesses.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Bonner, final word.
Thank you, Chair and members. And I'm so sorry that our other testifier was not able to be here with you today. She tells a harrowing story of experiencing first episode psychosis, her journey to recovery, and ultimately reclaiming her confidence and her success. And while she wasn't here today, I think it speaks volumes. And I encourage you, if you're able to see the testimony from the Behavioral Health Committee, it is really quite compelling to hear her tell you of her story. So I thank all of the members for listening today. I appreciate that this is a tried and true way for us to intervene early, and I'm hopeful that I will have your support.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. So with that, members, House File 1929 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. The last item on our agenda is House File 2733. I will move to adopt the division report from the Behavioral Health Division, and this will be a voice vote. All those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the report is adopted. My motion is to lay over House File 2733 to be included for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance and Omnibus Bill. Representative Bonner, this is your bill, I believe, as well. So please introduce the bill, and then we can go to your testifier.
Thank you, Chair and members. Yes, this is, again, one of mine. House File 2733. Is the result of 2 years of hard work that began in 2019 when we passed my bill for a community competency restoration task force. The intent of this bill was to address individuals that were found incompetent to stand trial and produced, my apologies, we passed the bill that created the task force to look into problems in Minnesota that is we are experiencing when a person is found incompetent to stand trial in a criminal court. The task force includes the hard work of Representative Albright and Representative Edelson. It is a companion to a larger, more comprehensive bill with recommendations on the competency restoration process. After 2 years, the Competency Restoration Task Force made MEC recommendations, and this bill is one important step in implementing them and building a community competency restoration system. The bill allows a path to Intensive Residential Treatment Services, or IRTS, or IRTS, facilities that can be locked to serve people who are coming from jail and may not be found, or may be found incompetent, to stand trial. Because of gaps in our legal system, our state hospital at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is serving a high number of people who have been found incompetent to stand trial and are civilly committed. When these people are ready to be discharged to a lower level of care, DHS and the counties work together to find a place for them to go. But there are many barriers. Many programs are not equipped to treat patients with criminal charges who have complex needs, especially while serving other populations not in their programs. This also means counties are paying the daily rate when a person does not meet criteria for the hospital, which is about, as mentioned earlier, somewhere between $1,300 to $1,600 a day. In a lot of cases, these people will move around from placement to placement, or they may just be returned to jail where they are not adequately receiving care to address their issues or being set back on a path to competency restoration. Locked IRTS facilities will provide a safe environment with staff that are trained and dedicated to serving patients with these very specific needs, and in a much more resource and therapeutic environment than a jail or a more expensive hospital setting. These facilities would be a great help in a complex situations, allowing judges to be more comfortable ordering people to a locked facility to get the treatment that they need and receive competency restoration services to get them back on the right path. The bill also provides startup funding to create these locked facilities out and about in the community. With that, I do have Sue Abderholden here to testify, and we also have Ms. Grom from DHS for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Ms. Abderholden, please state your name again for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. As Representative Bonner mentioned, this work comes out of the Community Competency Restoration Task Force. And I just wanted to say the task force included 25 members, and we obtained public input. We had public defenders, county attorneys, forensic psychologists and examiners, the Department of Human Services, Direct Care and Treatment, Department of Corrections, Minnesota counties and social service departments, mental health providers, victims, people with lived experience, advocates, and more. And one of the things we really wanted to make sure of is that we were able to provide community competency restoration services. Not everyone who is deemed incompetent to stand trial is actually committed, and not everyone who is deemed incompetent to stand trial needs hospital level of care. And so what we want to do is to develop alternative levels of care for these individuals so that they can get the treatment that they need and be restored to competency. I will mention that we have intensive residential treatment services or IRTS facilities in Minnesota, about 60 across the state. So it's something that we have a great deal of experience in. We know in talking to counties and providers that they are interested in doing this so that you could have a small IRTS facility. We could prevent people from sitting in jail while they're waiting for competency restoration, or they can be discharged to these types of facilities from Anoka Regional Treatment Center, which would also be helpful. The other thing to remind everyone of is that if they're in these smaller facilities, anything 16 beds or under, we can actually use Medicaid dollars. So we will have a source of funding to pay for the treatment that they need, which is different than, for example, at Anoka, where it's considered an IMD or Institute for Mental Disease. And of course, if you're in jail, You also can't access Medicaid. So I really feel this is kind of a win-win. We have a funding stream already. We just need some startup funds to help some of the providers develop these programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderhold. And just to clarify, we use a lot of acronyms here. So you said IRTS is the Intensive Residential Treatment?
Services.
Services. Okay, IRTS for members of the public. Okay, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd really like to thank Representative Bonner for bringing this bill forward, and to Ms. Abderhold and the a consortium of advocates. This is a part and parcel of a larger bill that, as was mentioned, Representative Edelson and I are moving through the committee. My only question, Madam Chair, for the author of the bill is, I do note, again, there's a blank appropriation here, and just to get our arms around, you know, what she is thinking for what would be an appropriate level of funding. I would hope that she would proffer a suggestion in terms of what would be an appropriate level of funding for this to neither undercut it nor overwhelm it at the same time.
Let's see, Representative Bonner or Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Abderholden.
Representative Albright. So we need to work with the Department of Human Services. They have provided startup funding in the past for IRTS facilities and our psychiatric residential treatment facilities. So we just want to get kind of an idea of what that amount would be. The ongoing funding is there. So it really is just trying to figure out what that startup cost would be needed for the facilities. Oftentimes when you open your doors, you don't get funding right away, but you have bills to pay. So we want to make sure that they're not, you know, frankly, delayed in being able to hire people. But we are working on that number, and we'll get it to you shortly.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I can honestly say the lineup today of the bills that we have heard really do address a number of issues that I think this state really needs to come to terms with. I think it's unfortunate that they're being laid over. I know some of the circumstances for which that's the preferred path, but these are ones that would stand on their own merits individually, Madam Chair, and I would hope that they would be taken under consideration as single traveling bills in as much as being laid over. We've both been around the circuit a number of times, so I understand and appreciate why this is being done, but I do hope that the members will take serious consideration for each one of these bills. I think they stand on their own merits, and I fully support each one of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I appreciate your support for these bills. And, you know, we're putting together our budget targets, and soon hopefully we'll have one. So we don't yet know what the appropriation will be for this last bill, so it would be hard to send it to the floor. But I agree with you. I would prefer passing individual bills off the floor, but I've been here a long time, and I understand why that's not why that doesn't always happen. But hopefully we can have support from our members to pass these bills if they do appear in an omnibus bill. And I also want to thank Chair Fisher for hearing these bills in his division and really focusing on behavioral health, so we can hear more bills this session in our committee that come from Chair Fisher's division. I don't know, Chair Fisher, did you want to add anything?
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Just the support for the bills that we've had come through from our division. There's been a lot of great work going on in a great bipartisan way. I'm looking forward to that continue as the other bills come forward.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. So with that, members, I'm not seeing any more questions. Representative Bonner, any last words?
Well, you've said much of what I would have said, which is that I agree wholeheartedly with Representative Albright. I am delighted to see that there has been such a high level of great bipartisan work being done on these bills with Representative Albright and Representative Edelson, and hearings in the Behavioral Health Committee with Representative Fisher. I thank them all for their support. Certainly, these do address a much deeper issue that we know needs to be addressed and does have to be dealt with. So I'm very grateful for that, and I hope to have all of your support.
Thank you, Representative Bonner, for working on this legislation and bringing this forward. So with that, members, House File 2733 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services, Finance, and Omnibus Bill. With that, members, wow, we are finished 30 minutes early. We are going to be meeting tomorrow, and let me just tell you what bills we're going to be hearing. We're going to be hearing House File 338, Representative Cleavorn's bill, House File 3524, another Representative Cleavorn bill, that's the homemaker rate increase bill. And then House File 2925, Representative Mueller is going to be introducing this bill to expand home and community-based services. So looking forward to hearing those bills, and all of those bills will be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, members, have a great rest of your day. I will see you here tomorrow, and we are adjourned.